Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Bria Barthel. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with information about a rally to be held in Troy on Friday, October 15th, to protest the way immigrants are treated by U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement, known as ICE. Then we'll hear an excerpt from a September 13th conference on voting rights, sponsored by the U.S. Congressional Black Caucus Foundation. After that, in the latest installment of Election Watch 2021, we'll hear from Rensselaer County Judge Jill Ken about the role of a family court judge and her views on how race and class affect those coming before her in the courtroom. After that, we have a look at Whitewashed, The Racism Project, a locally produced film about racial experiences that will be presented in Albany's Madison Theater. And in our final segment, we'll hear from singer, songwriter, and storyteller Kenyatta Emmanuel about his journey from prison to Carnegie Hall and challenges along the way. But first, here are the headlines.
The Times Union reports that a feud between rival biker gang associates apparently triggered the shootout at the private lounge in Albany over the weekend that left a 29-year-old military veteran dead and six others wounded. Police recovered nearly 70 shell casings at the scene. Law enforcement officials cite tensions caused by a proliferation of biker gangs that had recently formed in the region and others that had made a resurgence. The lounge is apparently a hangout for members of Suicide Squad, a local biker club. Allegedly, the Pagans Motorcycle Club were responding to a perceived insult.
The U.S. Supreme Court earlier this month rejected a request to hear the case of a public sector union members who had been seeking a retroactive refund of union fees or dues following the June 2018 Janus decision that made those dues voluntary rather than mandatory. In the Janus case, the court ruled that public sector unions could not charge mandatory dues-like fees, from people who worked in jobs with union representation.
In an unusually expensive campaign for Columbia County Sheriff, the Times Union reports that the largest donor to incumbent David Barrett's re-election campaign is a local gym owner who has been accused, along with three other individuals, of a gang assault that sent a man to the hospital. The donor's wife is a deputy sheriff who has also been charged in the assault.
The Times Union also reports that Albany voters in November will be asked to approve an Albany city law that would allow the Community Police Review Board to conduct independent investigations of police misconduct, issue subpoenas, and establish a, quote, disciplinary matrix, end quote, with the police chief. The law, if passed, is expected to trigger a legal battle with the police union. Local police reform advocates held a rally Wednesday in support of the law.
Capital Root, which delivers fresh produce to locations around the Capital Region, just added three new delivery sites in Schenectady County to their operation. The new sites are Mont Pleasant Commons Senior Housing, Edison Senior Housing, and Holly Manor. The expansion also includes a partnership with the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants in Albany, which provides vouchers to their clients to shop at any of the Capital Root's mobile markets.
The Gazette reports that the Schenectady Foundation has given a total of $450,000 in grants to six nonprofits for projects, quote, to reduce hunger and improve access to healthy, nutritious, and culturally appropriate foods, end quote. The six groups are the Regional Food Bank of Northeastern New York, Schenectady Community Ministries, Rotterdam's Messiah Lutheran Church, the Food Pantries of the Capital District, Capital Roots, and the Schenectady Green Market. Capital Roots will use $20,000 from the foundation to begin a Capital Region Food Policy Council.
50 Indigenous leaders on Thursday occupied the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C. The first time such an action had taken place in roughly 50 years, the group called on President Biden to ban any new industry leases to extract resources from public lands. This is the fourth day of direct action and arrests in D.C. by the People versus Fossil Fuels campaign, which is seeking Biden to halt new fossil fuels and declare and act on the climate emergency. And we had some stories, People's versus Fossil Fuels campaign, in our previous episode. On Friday, October 15th, the Sanctuary Movement will sponsor a rally to protest the way U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, treat immigrants. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Mark Dunley spoke with Elvia Garcia and Dahlia Yeand about the rally.
We're joined today by Elvia Garcia, who's a community organizer for the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement, Dahlia Yeand, who's also a coordinating committee member for the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement. And on Friday, October 15th at 2:30, they're going to be leading a march on the Rensselaer County jail, particularly to protest some of the activities related to ICE and the detention of immigrants at the county jail. The march will start at the Point, which is at the intersection of 3rd and 4th Street in South Troy, right next to Stewart. So welcome to the show. And why has the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement and others decided to hold this particular event?
Hi, Mark. Thank you so much for having us. It's really great to be on the show. I think one of the main reasons why we've decided to create this march is because multiple women have reported that they have experienced systemic violence, specifically at the Rensselaer County Jail in Troy. And we're here to, you know, call for authorities to investigate the abuse and inspect living conditions in the jail and release all the immigrant women. Specifically, Miss Q came forward not too long ago, who was a person who was detained in the jail experiencing physical abuse. So we're here to say this isn't okay, and we need to stop this. We need to we need to make an action, and we need to cut the contract immediately and release the women in the jail that are experiencing this horrible abuse.
Now, I noticed from an announcement for the march that one of the women had filed a civil rights complaint to the Department of Homeland Security about the inhumane and unsafe conditions at the Rensselaer County Jail. Has there been any response to that complaint?
No, I was going to say, I'm not aware that there has been any response to that complaint. I think that part of it is that the federal agency ICE and the privately owned detention facilities have a different set of guidelines than the county jails do. I believe there's no training done for the correction officers at these county jails for what those guidelines are. And because they're different, there's a disconnect there. So that could be a part of it as well.
Now, I do remember a number of years ago that many groups had protested the fact that the Rensselaer County Sheriff Russo, you know, had agreed to do this contract with ICE. I think maybe 287G is sort of the subtitle. And apparently Rensselaer County was the only county in New York State that agreed to do this. Has there been any, you know, effort by other county officials to, you know, get the Sheriff's Department to, you know, rescind this contract?
That's correct. Yeah. So I think one of the main reasons why maybe the sheriff hasn't is, although there are legislators, there are other county officials that disagree with it, at the end of the day, the sheriff is the one that decides it. And the county officials, like Steve McLaughlin and other local officials, are in support of it, and, you know, at the end of the day, have the rule over whether they want to or not to continue signing these horrible contracts.
Now, I also remember that a couple of years ago, this city of Troy City Council actually, even though it got watered down, was able to pass a resolution, you know, declaring the city of Troy a sanctuary city but then that was vetoed by Mayor Madden. Can you maybe just briefly discuss, you know, you all represent the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement. What is the Sanctuary Movement and how has that been progressing here, you know, locally?
I can speak to that fact. I was actually very vocal in getting that passed. I actually sat in personally with meetings with Mayor Madden, and he had stated, you know, to us and to other organizers that if the bill did get passed in Troy, or if the vote went through for Troy to become a sanctuary city, that he would approve it. And, you know, we had spoken to him on numerous occasions. And then when it did go through the vote and the Troy City Council voted and made Troy a sanctuary city, when the mayor did veto it, it was really a shock to all of us, being that he pretty much gave us his word that he wouldn't do something like that. So I think it's really disappointing that people who represent districts in Troy actually did the right thing and voted correctly on that bill. And they, you know, on that, and Troy should be a sanctuary city if it's going by the word of the people. But, you know, the actions of the mayor kind of spoke differently to that.
Speaking a little bit more about Columbia County Sanctuary Movement specifically, we are an organization here in Columbia County based in Hudson that advocates and defends our immigrant community. We recognize that we also have members outside of the Columbia County, and we're very close to Rensselaer County. A lot of our members actually, you know, live in Rensselaer County and Albany County. So the Capital District is also our homes. And, you know, a lot of the problems that we face also come from these regions as well. So, you know, being a part of these actions also affect our members, also affect members across the state and, you know, statewide. So, of course, we're going to be here advocating for everyone in the state.
Now, we're talking with Alvia Garcia and Delia Yen from the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement. There is a rally in March starting at 2:30 Friday, October 15th at the point at 3rd and 4th Street intersection, and marching down to the sheriffs. Do you want to quickly walk us through what are the activities planned for Friday?
On Friday, October 15th, we will meet at the park. Well, it's the intersection or the meeting of 3rd and 4th Street in Troy, New York. We will meet. The meeting time is around 2:30 p.m. And then we aim to get people kind of organized in that area and march down to RCJ. We are hoping to get everyone down at the county jail by about 3:30 p.m. And when we get there, we'll be hearing from Miss Sister and various other community organizers.
Now, I was there a couple of years ago, and I remember that, you know, people sat down to block the road and trying to get arrested, and the county decided to just avoid the issue. You know, what can people do, you know, besides joining the rally and the march this Friday? Are there other things people can be doing to sort of pressure Sheriff Russo to both improve the behavior, but also in this contract? And, you know, also, how do we go about demanding the release of the immigrants presently detained there? What can people do to support this?
Right. We actually have a county sign-on letter for legislators. So we're right now trying to call our legislators in support of making sure that our legislators pressure the county as well to end the contract. So what you can do, I can send over some info and some scripts, but you can call your legislators, let them know, hey, this is happening in Rensselaer County. Can you sign on to this letter, support letter? And then also, if you're a local, it's an election year, y'all. It's a lot of these local officials are, you know, on the ballot this November. So we can rise up and we can make a change for sure.
And I assume Columbia County Sanctuary Movement has a website and or Facebook page that people could check out?
Yeah, you can check out our website and our Facebook page. Columbia County Sanctuary Movement is our name. So yeah, for more information, let us know. It'll be on our website and also our Facebook.
Also, if I could just chime in, I'm also affiliated with Ice Free Capital District, which also will be in present, and they have a Facebook page that you can check out for events like this also.
Thank you very much, Avia Garcia and Delilah Yen from the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement. Friday, 2:30 at the Point, 3rd and 4th Street, Troy, New York. And this has been Mark Dunlay for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
You can find more information on the Cut the Ice contract, Free Them All event on Facebook. The rally begins at 2:30 p.m. on October 15th at Terrace Shevchenko Park at the intersections of 3rd and 4th Streets in South Troy.
Now Hudson Mohawk Magazine's roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry shares excerpts from a September 13th conference sponsored by the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation on the topic of winning the fight for voting rights.
Our next co-host is Senator Warnock, Georgia's first Black United States Senator, who served as a senior pastor of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Senator Warnock.
Hello, everybody. But indeed, we are focused now on one of our country's most sacred and fundamental rights, the right to vote. And as I've said on the floor of the Senate and to people in every corner of my state, Congress must pass voting rights no matter what. Voting rights are preservative of all other rights. That means that we have to do everything we can to defend the voices of the people in our democracy. And right now, can there be any question at all that our democracy is under attack? In many ways, last November's election could be viewed as our nation's most successful election. Not because of who won, but because of who showed up. We had the largest turnout of any election. And since last November, and since my election in January, more than 400 voter suppression bills have been introduced in 49 states. 18 states have passed 30 laws to restrict voting access. My home state of Georgia is ground zero for voter suppression. Earlier this year, Georgia's state legislature passed SB 202, making it harder to vote for countless Georgians by creating hurdles for voters to request an absentee ballot, by reducing the number of drop boxes where voters can return their ballots, by making it harder for community organizations to assist voters, and by making it possible for a single person, imagine that, a single person to make unlimited challenges to the ability of other Georgians to vote. And as if that weren't enough, Georgia's law also allows partisan actors at the state level to control our state board of elections and take over local elections, which they are threatening to do right now. And it allows them to engage in these takeovers even while the votes are still being cast. Our federal government and Congress specifically must act. It is our duty. It is our responsibility. It is within our purview. We must pass federal voting rights protections to provide a national baseline for voting, basic standards that apply no matter what state you live in. And that's why I'm working so hard right now for voting rights in the Senate. Because voting rights is not just an issue alongside other issues. And so I'm working hard with my colleagues in the Senate to get this done. And I know that all of you are standing with me in this fight. We do this work together. And so as I conclude my remarks, I think of Congressman John Lewis. He inspired me in life, and his witness speaks even from the grave. As I was preparing last summer to preside over his funeral, and I thought about the footage that many of us have seen time and time again of him crossing that Edmund Pettus Bridge, I asked myself, what was John Lewis thinking? In fact, what was Hosea Williams thinking as they crossed that Edmund Pettus Bridge? I assure you that he was not thinking about winning a Presidential Medal of Freedom. That's not why he did it. He was not thinking that somehow he would walk into glory and that at the end of his life, at his funeral, three American presidents would show up on both sides of the aisle to pay him homage. He could not have imagined that. John Lewis stood up for voting rights because it was the right thing to do. He was inspired by the words of Dr. King, who in 1957 said, "Give us the ballot, and we will place on the benches in the South judges who will do justice and love mercy. And we will place at the head of Southern states governors who have not only felt the tang of the human, but the glow of the divine." This is a critical moment, and our country is at an inflection point, similar to the one we faced in 1965. Make no mistake, we are in a 911 emergency for our democracy. History is watching us. The future is waiting to see if we will act. Let's stay in this fight until the victory is won.
Now we are in panel two of our Voting Rights Brain Trust. Again, let's start with who I'm going to say, she's my governor. This is Stacey Abrams, the chair of Fair Fight Action. Speaking of fighting, I want to start with someone who's trying to engage us in a fair fight, but Stacey, they're not playing fair. So tell us how we can do that in this day and age with more than 400 voter suppression laws being introduced in states all over the country, including your own. What's fair about that fight?
There is nothing fair about the fight, which is why we exist. And Angela, I want to say thank you to you and certainly to Representative Sewell for your extraordinary leadership. It's an honor to be on this panel. Very quickly, what we need to recognize is that we are at a turning point in democracy. This isn't just about winning elections. This is about the fundamental nature of the kind of country we want to be. And we have, over the last 20 years, watched stable democracies fall to authoritarianism. We pretend that that could never happen to us, and we know it's not true. What we are fighting for are three things. One is the right to vote, which undergirds the nature of democracy. And that is made very clear through the fight for, against those 400 bills you referenced, and thus the fight for the People Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that the House has passed. But the second part, you get the right to vote and you secure it. The second part is having the right to elect the people who represent you. And that's the work that Attorney General Holder is doing, the work that we've been doing through Fair Count, a second organization I founded that really looks at who do we get to pick. And then the third piece is really pushing back against the subversion of our democracy. The bills that we are seeing passing in Texas, in Georgia, in Iowa, these laws will allow them to overturn elections. And if we forget, the goal of January 6th was the subversion of our democracy. And thus, if we do not stand up and pass these bills that will push back against the attempt to not only stop us from participating, but to take away our choices and then to silence our voices once we've made a decision, we will not only not have a fair fight, we will no longer have a democracy that's worth speaking of in this country.
We will move right along to Jalen. I want to come to you because, you know, the organization is called More Than a Vote. And I think so often, again, we keep people in this box that is confined specific to the vote. There's the fight around the vote. There's the political power they have the ability to exercise after they cast the ballot and before they've casted the ballot. What are some of the other things, some of the other tools that you think is really important for folks who would say, I'm going to listen because Jalen is talking to about this. What's something else that folks need to be aware of, Jalen, in this fight for voting rights?
Here you go, a perfect example. And I'm going to use how sports had a huge effect. And I'm a Michigan native, but also have family in Georgia. And the WNBA were the first people I saw with Vote Warnock shirts on. I didn't know who that was. I remember being in Georgia, seeing people wearing those shirts because the WNBA players were doing it. How about the Milwaukee Bucks? They just won the championship this year. They were the first team that decided in the bubble that they weren't going to play after the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And you know what they did during that couple of hours? They started calling and calling again, like you guys have just been advised today. And those voices became sirens because this is a two-time MVP in Giannis Antetokounmpo. And there are a lot of sponsors expecting this game to start at 7 p.m. and they're not out there. That's how the power of sports and or your voice can now make other people want to muzzle you because they recognize that you have that power. And so when you exercise it and you see it play out the way those two circumstances did, I don't have to tell any of you, it flipped the election. It literally flipped the election. And so it's really important one by one. And I have to just say this. I'm still arguing with some people, to be honest with you, about getting vaccinated. I remember arguing with people about wearing seatbelts. You remember that time? Oh, it's uncomfortable. People riding in the car, stick your arm out. You didn't want to wear a seatbelt. I remember 13 and under, the first time, 15 and under, I believe. Whatever, I'm getting old. The first time I got on the airplane, the people on the airplane were smoking cigarettes. And I was like, I can't believe you can smoke cigarettes on an airplane, right? That's the same thing I bring up with vaccinations and voting. There was a time in this country that we didn't necessarily trust the system because there was nobody running that looked like us. I was there when that changed. I was at the inauguration when Barack Obama got elected. That day it changed for us. And so don't take your voice, don't take your vote for granted. Make sure locally, nationally, we continue to up the ante because this year more people voted than ever. And so we have to continue that momentum.
Thanks to Hudson Mohawk Magazine's roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry for bringing us that excerpt from September 13th Conference on Voting Rights. For more information, visit morethanavote.org. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey.
And I'm Bria Barthel. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany, and we broadcast online also. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. For our next segment, Judge Jill Ken, appointed as acting family court judge in 2015, will face challenger Ann Conrad in the role for Rensselaer family court judge when voters go to the polls on November 2nd. Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with Judge Ken.
Judge Keen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
It's my pleasure to be here this afternoon.
How long have you served as a family court judge?
Well, I was elected to the bench in 2014. I was elected to as Troy City Court judge immediately upon my swearing in, which was in January of 2015. I was assigned to be acting family court judge in Rensselaer County. So from 2015, I have been acting family court judge in Rensselaer County. And not long after, I believe it might have been in 2016, I was assigned to be acting family court judge in Columbia County. So I would go to Columbia County as well to assist with their family court calendars.
It's a difficult role. How are you finding this experience?
It's very challenging. You know, when I ran for city court, I really had no anticipation that I would be assigned to family court. But I have to tell you, it has become a vocation almost for me. I find that I'm very passionate about the work that I do. It is exceedingly challenging. I'm not going to sugarcoat the role at all. It's a very busy court. We have a very high volume. And anytime you're dealing with matters of children and family, it can be very highly emotional. And it's difficult, but I think I find it very rewarding.
What kinds of matters do family court judges deal with?
Family court judges, I would say the majority of our time are dealing with custody, contested custody matters between parents of children that are no longer living together as an intact family. And they're trying to resolve how to accommodate that shift in the paradigm of the family. So a lot of times we're dealing with those custody issues where the parties cannot agree on matters of access or what decisions to make. They're unable to come to a decision regarding their children. Today, for example, was my DSS day, which is where I deal almost all day with matters of neglect and abuse brought on by the Department of Social Services, juvenile delinquent petitions, and person in need of supervision petitions. So those are all matters that fall under our what we call our DSS matters. We also deal with family offense petition, and that's when a member of a household is seeking an order of protection against another member of their household. And we hear those matters on an emergency basis. So for example, today, I believe I had three emergencies. So people come into the court building, they file their petition, and they are heard immediately, or as soon as we can accommodate them, they're heard by a judge to make a determination as to whether or not it would be appropriate for an order of protection to be issued. I also deal with adoptions, which is a wonderful, happy part of my job, I must say.
What past experiences have you had before you became a judge that you feel make you really well suited for this position?
Well, first and foremost, I believe being a parent and understanding the dynamic of a relationship, of being a parent, of being a partner in a relationship, including children, I think that you bring that experience with you to whatever you do. So I think in this job especially, it's important. I've also acted as assistant county attorney for 5 years. And during that time, I was assigned to prosecute what we call AOTs, which are assisted outpatient treatment. So these are individuals that for whatever reason are either a danger to themselves or to society. And we are looking to make sure that they abide by a treatment plan, which would include housing or treatment. And that was my job to deal exclusively with those cases. In addition, I also was the, I don't want to say backup person, but I think that's what I was for cases dealing with family court in Rensselaer County Family Court, cases that are prosecuted by the county attorney's office, such as the neglect and the juvenile delinquency proceedings that I have described. So I did have experience as an attorney in the court, specifically in family court. And I think my experience relative to the AOT really opened my eyes to the struggles that people suffering from mental illness, and the struggles and challenges that they have. And I think that understanding has led me to be compassionate and, again, understanding into the struggles that they have.
You mentioned compassion. What are the three most important qualities you think a family court judge ought to have?
I think temperament is a good one, and patience. I don't know if they go hand in hand, but I think that patience is exceedingly important because these are very trying cases. People are very emotional. I think it is important for the judge to remain a calming presence because, as you know, people become very agitated and emotional when they're talking about their children, as anyone would be. I think compassion plays a role in it as well. I also think having a strong sense of justice and of fairness. Fairness is above all what is expected in a courtroom and what the litigants are entitled to.
Do you think that race and class play a role in the cases that come before you?
Are you talking about systemic racism?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good answer. I guess I'm curious whether you think in the cases that come before you, someone's race or their class affects the way that they either enter the system or are dealt with in the system. And systemic racism, I suppose, is one way to look at it. I'm just curious about your thoughts about that.
I think that the way that the system is perceived by a person, I think, has to do with their race, perhaps, and their class, if they feel that they haven't been properly or fairly represented previously that may affect their approach. So I think racism and classism affects every experience a person has. I will say that I do think that, especially in the family court, where every parent and every child is entitled to an attorney. And the attorneys that work in family court are so passionate about their work. They are fabulous attorneys that I really don't think often people understand the really great job that these folks do for them. So I don't think in terms of actually, if you're assigned because you can't afford an attorney and you are assigned an attorney, that does not mean that you're getting a lesser degree of representation, because the attorneys that I work with in family court are top notch, and I would not hesitate to recommend them or to be represented by them myself. But I think that it's important as a judge that, again, I have to be aware of the struggles that people have in a particular financial situation and perhaps attitudes that may exist within a particular culture. And I think I am very cognizant of that. And I never would want anyone to feel that they were being treated differently because of their socioeconomic class.
Judge, where can we find you when you're not on the campaign trail and you're not in a courtroom? Where can we find you relaxing or finding peace?
Family. I mean, family is, and I can't say it enough, it's a recurring theme in my life. My husband and I have three adult children, and unfortunately for me, they've all moved out of the area. I'm so lucky that my parents are still with us. We enjoy spending time with them. I love to travel. I'm an avid reader. And I guess I have to admit that I love to shop. And my husband would say that I'm a first-class shopper. So, a bargain hunter. How about that?
That's great. Well, I really enjoyed speaking with you about your role as a family court judge, and I thank you for your time, and stay safe on the campaign trail.
Thank you, and I'd love to meet you in person sometime. It would be a pleasure.
You can find more Election Watch 2021 candidate interviews on our website at mediasanctuary.org.
The locally produced film Whitewashed, The Racism Project, is premiering at Albany's Madison Theater on October 15th. Khaleesia Smith spoke with actors Danielle Collin and Aaron Moore.
My name is Dee Collin, and I am one of the members of the cast for Whitewash the Racism Project. I'm actually an original cast member.
Right.
I'm also a poet, visual artist, and educator living in Troy.
I am Aaron Moore. I am a performance artist here in the Capital Region community. I'm also one of the original performers in Whitewashed. And I'm a acting instructor, performing arts education instructor, here in the Capital Region.
Briefly, can you both briefly describe this film?
The film is really an adaptation of the play that we were in by the same name, Whitewashed, The Racism Project, which we collaborated in writing in 2019, and then performed on different stages. The goal of the piece, when we were writing, the goal was really to talk about racism. And that's a big umbrella word. And so we had like a lot of, you know, things to talk about when it came to trying to really capture what racism is and also how it has connected throughout history and how it appears now. I don't know. Aaron wants to add to that.
No, you said it exactly how I felt. It's a piece that looks at American history and Black culture within American history and how it's been, talks about how it's been whitewashed over the years and kind of looks very in-depth look at that culture and not just the history, excuse me, but it looks at the impact emotionally that whitewashing this culture has in the world. So I would say that, just add that on. But no, I completely agree with what you did on the explanation of the play.
But now that it's a film, you're going to have a larger impact on a wider audience. How do you hope that that broader impact will change the people watching it?
I hope that it facilitates deeper conversations. When we performed it live, we always had a talk back after the play. And so people could ask questions and, you know, we answer questions. But in this context, you know, as a film, people can have longer, deeper conversations about what they just watched and also, you know, what they can do moving forward.
I absolutely agree with Dee. It gives people an opportunity to take these conversations in their homes. So we'll take the performance. I hope they've been taking the conversations in their homes, but they can able to kind of take this performance now and put it up in their homes and sort of make it tangible and visual for their family. So one thing when we have those talkbacks, one thing I would always bring up is, you know, those for the, you know, this play isn't for those who've come out and see it, but it's for the people in the lives of those who came out and see this play, meaning, you know, their family, their friends, partners, coworkers, things of that nature, who, you know, are indeed racist and who indeed say racist things and are either curious about how to overcome this or kind of need a kick, little kick in the butt when it comes to understanding the torment and treatment of Black people throughout the ages. So now it gives even more responsibility to those people and also less wiggle room for excuses of not having these conversations. So I'll just add that little tidbit.
That is so powerful because I think sometimes people forget that we do impact others. So I can definitely see how people seeing this film, especially based on the way that you described it, how it'll be almost like a chain reaction from the people who have seen it and to the people in their lives. Yeah, that is so important.
I want to bounce off that a little bit because one of the things that was really important to Michael Kennedy, the director, was to give us agency. And we had complete freedom on what we wanted to put in the script and what stories we wanted to tell. And that's not always the case when it comes to our stories, you know? So I think for me, like I've been so really invested in this whole process because of that, you know, that it's so unapologetic and honest and authentic. And, you know, we're not only performing on the stage, we're also writers for a lot of the content as well. So that's really important, I think, you know, so that people can really hear not just history, but they can hear our current voices.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, unfortunately, there's been a lot of performative allyship. Excuse the pun, but like performative allyship in the performance community up here. So, you know, I felt that this was sort of the atmosphere, as Dee said, the atmosphere that Michael Kennedy sort of forced and put out there in the air quite early on was just a huge relief. And, you know, than it has been for many of the other local entities here in the Capital Region area when it comes to promoting Black artists. So it was quite a relief.
When I first saw the film and I heard Michael Kennedy and I saw that she was a white woman, one of the first things that I thought of was that it would be whitewashed way, only because there's been so many times where you see anything about Black history or Black culture that is produced or marketed via like a white entity that things are different. And that's such a concern in the Black community or in any community. Can you talk about how your partnership with Michael Kennedy to produce this film, the backlash that is usually associated with white people coming into Black spaces, even to just help create art? Can you?
So for me, I was very weary of it because there's a lot, there has been, and unfortunately still are, like a lot of white entities that sort of use Black voices as an authentic avatar for diversity, for just openness, where, you know, it's so much almost like tokenizing almost. And I'm very conscious of who I work with and who I don't work with. Kind of going into this project and having worked with Michael before, knowing she's a wonderful director, just an amazing artist, kind of hearing the idea of what she wanted to do. And of course, herself being white, I definitely was like on the fence, and it kind of took me some convincing to sort of see, all right, what's going on? But I can't say that Michael came into this with respect, with responsibility, humbly realizing she is indeed a white woman and realizing the project that she's undertaking and the people that she's looking to collaborate with, and making focus that our voices and our wants and needs remain first.
Yeah, it was definitely a collective collaboration throughout. And something that really stood out for me early on in the writing process, you know, it's an all Black cast. And Michael said, do you want to talk about this? And I'll step outside. And that said a lot to me. And she did. She stepped outside so we could have our Black talk.
Yeah.
And that's how she's really protected the energy with us.
Yeah.
And I really appreciate that kind of care. Also, you know, the things we're talking about in Whitewashed are really heavy. Like it's an intense piece, you know, and there are some scenes where we needed to breathe, we needed to take a break. It's so much deeper than the surface of that, you know, what Aaron's talking about, performative allyship, you know, it's knowing how not to take up too much space, you know, and understanding how much space you're taking up and where you need to like step away, step back a little bit. It's not easy to do this work, and that kind of work, you know, when you are trying to make change, influence change, inspire change in some way using your art, it can be a lot, you know, but we were able to do that together and support each other and lift each other up, really like dig deep. And this is not like a lightweight piece, you know. We have been, you know, every time you're on stage, you feel all the things all over again. I've never seen anything like this, you know, on stage.
No.
So I'm proud of us for producing something like this.
I saw the trailer and I was like, that was intense.
Yeah. Bring tissues.
Bring tissues.
Thank you guys so much for doing this interview with me.
Khaleesia Smith spoke with Danielle Collin and Aaron Moore. Locally produced Whitewash, The Racism Project will be showing at the Madison Theater for two consecutive weekends, beginning on October 15th.
In our final segment, singer, songwriter, and musician Kenyatta Emmanuel talks about his music as storytelling and his journey from prison to Carnegie Hall.
Hello, it's Andrea Connell from Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm here speaking with Kenyatta Emmanuel, songwriter, an artist, and an activist.
Thank you.
You're a musician.
Well, I am primarily a storyteller. Oh. And music is the medium that I find most accessible. And so it is what I most consistently use for communication purposes. Music was present in my life continually. While it may not have been in a formalized way, or even in a necessarily specifically creative way, that music is present all the time. For I think all of us, I think each of us are artists. So I was raised around music and with a certain context. And then I don't think that I was necessarily engaged in it in an active way. It was more a matter of, you know, how music is the soundtrack of our lives and the things that seem to resonate with me. And I just always had a very eclectic, thanks to and hearing, you know, hearing the blues and hearing jazz, hearing country music and pop music and all of these different forms of music, not a lot of opera, but some. That wasn't until later through a program at Carnegie So this is the pot that I was kind of growing out of and still listening to. I was fortunate in that I was able to always kind of keep those flavors in my life. So there was a willingness to always be open to a variety of musical and artistic experiences. And then many, 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 many years later, I want to say I was about 22, would be the first time, if we won't call it formalized training, then what we'll call it is intentional instruction. I was incarcerated at Greenhaven Correctional Facility. I was about 22 years old, and there was a guy there, and Dave was a jazz musician. I had already decided that I wanted to do it just as a matter of passing time. I was playing keyboard. I was learning to play. I was learning to write music.
How would you describe your work?
I've long had difficulty sort of placing a label on what it is I do. Music that is about our connection one to another. It is about our humanity. It's about what is important. So sometimes that takes the form that feels like country, right? Because I grew up loving, you know, Garth Brooks and George Strait and Johnny Cash and Charlie Pride. And sometimes it takes a form that feels like jazz because I love Bird and I love Brubeck. And, you know, and sometimes it feels a little reggae-ish because I love Bob Marley, right? And there's soul because, you know, Marvin is in there and Teddy is in there and Aretha is in there and Prince is in there and everything that that means. And similarly, I would say that my music is non-denominational.
Well, I know that you've even put your foot or your toes
in
into opera.
Opera,
right?
Yeah, with Joyce DiDonato, who's awesome.
You wrote the music to a poem.
A poem, Langston Hughes's poem. And the opportunity to perform, to do this show for the Met. And, you know, she talked about how she was used to leverage the privilege and the position, the life that she has built and the world, you know, the way that the world now regards her and the way that the world is willing to listen to her. It's the definition of a platform. How can I use this feeling, hey, I have to draw attention to some things that are happening that we need to see that are talking about racism, oppression, equality, and equity. And I felt very honored and gratified that she would contact me in the first place. And so that's a remarkable testament to our relationship. I'm glad that she considered me in that role. But the text of the poem, Langston Hughes, I Dream a World, it couldn't have been better because I think that it was a recognition that things are not as they ought to be. However, there is also an aspiration that things need not be as they are. That to me is the most important element of my music, sometimes stated plainly that very way in a lyric in the song. I hope that my music compels people, implores people, facilitates folks in examining and recognizing the way that the world is right now. I would also hope that it will inspire them to dream, to recognize, and to know that the way that it is not how it has to be. It is not this out of necessity, that there is better and it can be better if we're going to work. If, you know, it's going to require some work. You know, sometimes you got to, you know, you put your shoulder to the wheel, as we used to say, you know, and push. But the point is, the wheel will move. It's a big wheel. So it might take a lot of us to do it, but it'll move. You know, and I just want to remind us, hey, it'll move.
Lots of stuff I'd love to talk to you about.
Sure.
But one thing I can't escape, which is kind of a good word to use at this point, because
sure,
you didn't escape. You left Sing Sing.
I did.
And
yeah, I did.
That morning,
well, no,
evening, you went to Carnegie Hall. So I don't know which journey we should talk about, how you got to Sing Sing, what happened in Sing Sing, or how you got to Carnegie Hall.
Practice, practice, practice. So I think it is a significant journey, and there is so much that is present in it that if I could take the liberty, I'll truncate it and mention a couple of things that I think are important to mention. The first is that I did not, I'm not wrongfully accused, just in case anybody's wondering. I was absolutely guilty, and I took another human being's life. I say that to not to harp on it or to ever keep it fresh or to keep it present, but as a sort of recognition that within my story, the story that I've chosen to own, these are key points of the narrative that I must never distance myself from. During that time of incarceration, 24 and a half years, because I got 6 months off for limited credit time allowance because I went to school. During that time, I had remarkable opportunities like educational opportunities, which are not available to everyone who is incarcerated in the United States or even in New York State, just so we're clear. Also, musical opportunities in that space. Carnegie Hall's Musical Connections program came in, and I began to build a relationship with these other musicians. David at Green Haven, which was many, many years before I was at Sing Sing. So Sing Sing is far more recognized. It's a character of its own. And learning how to play guitar in this sort of jazz style, proper theory from him, which I had on papers and whatever. And later on, I was able to go back and reference as I left him. But with other musicians who were playing, we were playing songs and we were learning the things that each other knew. I like the blues. So when guys listen, they're looking at, I'm showing them how I bend these particular notes, how I think in this particular way of these particular slides, this sort of 12-bar blues progression, this feel, what it is to have these substitution, these chords, whatever. And I have a friend there who likes rock. He loves these power chords, which I was like, these things are so simple, but he began to use them in a way. Also, I learned from them as a guitar player, play for people who are listening, don't play for other guitarists. Don't try and do crazy things with your fingers so the people who play guitar would be like, he's amazing. Play the thing that is going to speak to the people who are listening. And eventually we come to a place where I'm leaving Fishkill, actually. I didn't leave from Sing Sing. When you're about to leave, you go to a medium security facility where they process you and go through all this. So I actually went, actually exited from Fishkill medium security, because Sing Sing is maximum security. And that night, that was on October 21st, 2019. And having built those relationships, many of those artists, we went to Carnegie Hall that night from the songs that I had, that I'd written, let's put together a set list. They were like, well, hey, can we support you in this way? Can we support you in this way? How can we help you with this? Eventually, performance at Carnegie in the Whale Wild Music Room on the night that I'd come home. So I was released that morning, and my wife and I drove there. We had an opportunity to rehearse with. So we had the 17 teaching artists. These were musicians with whom I had established relationships for years. They'd come in and we talked about theory. We talked about music. Some of them had introduced me to not just songs, but certain types of music that I'd never even, you know, heard before. A cultural appreciation versus appropriation, an immersion and submersion, and a recognition of us awashing one another in our.
So you really ended up blending all sorts of influences within your own.
Right. I've come to realize that I thought of it as finding my voice as an artist, but you don't really find your voice as an artist. I think you kind of grow into it. We can just be honest and be true to what our voice is in this moment. My physical voice doesn't sound like now like it did 20 years ago. The instrument itself has changed like any other living instrument. I think that I was fortunate in that when I began an intentional search, an intentional exploration, if you will, of my voice, to walk into the spaces that it is and see what was living there. When I'm finding what my voice would be, all of this information.
This has been Andrea Cunliffe for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, speaking with Kenyatta Emmanuel.
And Kenyatta Emmanuel will be at the Collard City Mushrooms opening this weekend in conjunction with Bliss Arts, October 16th, along with poet Jose Perez, celebrating the opening of John Zoccoli's art exhibition.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Sina Bazila-Hickey, also your engineer.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.